Welcome to the Just Pod, a podcast by the Criminal Justice Section of the ABA, the unified voice of criminal justice. Welcome to this episode of the Just Pod. Today, we have Kristen Henning joining us. Kristen, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yes, it's our pleasure. Kristen is the Bloom Professor of Law and Director of the Juvenile Justice Clinic and Initiative at Georgetown Law, and is a member of the CJS Juvenile Justice Standards Task Force currently. So Kristen is here to discuss her recently published book, The Rage of Innocence, How America Criminalizes Black Youth. And I just gave some of her current titles, but Kristen, there's much more to your professional background that's relevant to helping establish why it is that you were in a position to write this book. So would you please take a moment and tell our listeners more about your professional experience and background before we begin our discussion of your book?
Well, sure. I live in the Washington, D.C. area and represent children accused of delinquency in the D.C. Superior Court. As you said, I am the director of the Juvenile Justice Clinic and Initiative at Georgetown. So I take my law students into court and we represent kids. Before that, I was at the DC Public Defender Service representing kids. And so for the last 26 years, I have been representing children accused of delinquency in the nation's capital. In addition to that, I train state actors, judges, prosecutors, defense attorneys, prosecutors, and the like in issues related to race, adolescence, and policing.
Okay, thank you for sharing that. And so listeners, I told you the title of the book already, The Rage of Innocence, How America Criminalizes Black Youth. And I'm sure in listening to Kristen share more of her background, you can join with me in recognizing why Kristen is in a position to speak with authority on this subject. So let's dig into your book a little bit. As the title says, the primary focus of this book is to unpack how policies and the current criminal justice system and policing practices are disparate in their impact of the criminalization of Black youth. So, Kristen, would you give our listeners some highlights from your work to help them better understand what they can look for in this book?
Yes. So, you know, as I said to you, I've been representing children in the nation's capital now for 26 years. And here is what's so important. In that entire 26 years, I have only represented 4 white children. Every other child that I have represented has been an African-American child. And that is such a profound statement. You know, it would relieve some of our readers to believe, or listeners, I should say, to believe either that there are no white children in the nation's capital or that white children don't commit crime. And we know that's not true. So this book explores the criminalization of Black children in particular. And I talk about the criminalization in 3 broad ways. First, I talk about the criminalization of normal adolescent behaviors. And in particular, I'm talking about just the ways in which we arrest and prosecute children, Black children in particular, for doing what teenagers do all over the country. And so the way I like to think about this is just to ask yourselves, what were those things that you cared most about when you were a teenager? It was what? The clothes that you wore, the friends that you sat with in the cafeteria, the music that you listened to, you know, the parties that you got invited to, those kinds of things we really, really cared about. And I could pick any sort of one of those areas and show how Black children are criminalized. So let's think about music for a moment. Think about pop, rock, heavy metal, country music, all of those genres have misogynistic, violent themes, themes related to drugs, alcohol, things that adults don't approve of. But we don't think about those genres of music as dangerous or violent. But yet, you know, we look at rap music and it is considered the most dangerous music alive, exploring many of the exact same themes that appear in all other genres, as well as some positive, affirming socio-political messages. So that's just one example. Another example is clothes, right? Kids care about the clothes that they wear. And we think about, you know, the hippie era when folks were wearing tie-dye t-shirts and bell bottoms that were associated with drug use and, you know, hallucinogens and things of that nature. But we never criminalized that. We didn't even criminalize, right, the all black attire with the straight black hair that was associated with the goth era, which again, associated with violence, mass shootings. And then I even think about today, we think about the steel-toed Doc Martin shoes that have been proclaimed by some white supremacist groups. Again, we don't criminalize those, yet we stop and think about sagging pants. For example, there are laws on the books that make it a crime to wear sagging pants. So thereby targeting a fashion statement that has been associated with hip hop or Black adolescent culture. We also think about the Black hoodie or just a hoodie in general. And when a Black hoodie is associated with a Black child, it is criminalized or demonized. So those are just some examples of the criminalization of normal adolescent behaviors. In the book, the other two broad areas that I talk about are the policing of Black children, the hyper surveillance and the aggressive policing strategies of Black children. And to be clear, when I talk about policing in this book, I am not just talking about policing in a blue uniform, but also policing by proxy, policing by all of us civilians who walk through a park or walk through our communities and are afraid of Black children and call the police. And then that third area is the dehumanization of Black children who do make a mistake. So remember that first category was criminalizing behaviors that shouldn't be criminalized at all. But then there is the dehumanizing responses and severe sentences, transfer and prosecution of children from juvenile court to adult court. And this happens far more often with Black children than white children. And with white children, we often find a way to rehabilitate them, to guide them, to offer rehabilitative solutions for them. But for Black children, we really have severe and draconian responses.
Yeah, thank you. You know, as you were speaking, one, I didn't know that there were laws criminalizing saggy pants in some jurisdictions. Yeah. That seems crazy. But I was reminded at our Fall Institute in November, the CJS Fall Institute, as you were speaking, our closing panel featured two young men that had been criminalized. They had been in the system, not that they hadn't committed crime, but as you're talking about how the system just treats them differently, even if they do, you know, make mistakes. And they were speaking, they were sharing their experiences and how they were moving forward from that path when the Kyle Rittenhouse verdict was declared. And the one thing that really stood out to me was that they, you know, they maintained ownership of what they had done, though they didn't disclose what had specifically led them to their time being incarcerated. What was so heartbreaking was to see how, just see the pain that they felt when they were talking about how the system had humanized Kyle Rittenhouse. And they weren't necessarily saying that that was the wrong thing to do, but that they weren't given that when it was their time in the system. And I you felt that it was palpable and it was heartbreaking to see. I'm sorry, I did not disclose these. I think maybe I missed saying that these two young men were Black men. So it was very impactful. And I think that's one of the things, and especially when we hear from advocates that have been in the system, they get the benefit of humanizing. You know, you've had time representing these youth that has given you the chance to see them as humans. Sometimes when we're separated from events or crimes, that element can get lost. And so anyway, I just appreciate you sharing all those insights as our listeners try and take that all in. And now I'd like to know a little bit more, and for our listeners as well, would you tell us a little bit more about the process for how you collected the information and formed the conclusions put forward in this work?
Yeah, so the Rage of Innocence, How America Criminalizes Black Youth, is absolutely a compilation of, you know, indeed, my, you know, sort of 26 years of representing children. And throughout that time, I have always sort of kept a folder, whether that be a paper folder or an electronic folder, of what I call shock and awe cases. And by that, I mean shock and awe that this child is in the system in the first place, and why it is, I find myself asking why it is that we have chosen to respond to children in this way. And so, you know, I think everybody should do that. Like, you doing this work as a defender, you can become complicit, even as a defense attorney, in the criminalization of Black children if we don't stop and think, well, one, you know, would a white child, just like you talked about with Kyle Rittenhouse, would a white child be prosecuted at all? And if they're prosecuted, how would it look differently? And so for me, that was part of it, was collecting these stories over the years that really best illustrated the contrast between how Black children and white children are treated. So that's one. And so in addition to, you know, my own clients, I wanted to weave together some of the high profile cases that we all know about, but I wanted to talk about in a different way. And so, you know, cases like Tamir Rice, of course, and Mike Brown, who people like to forget was just a child, folks like Jordan Davis and Jordan Edwards and Trayvon Martin. But I wanted to look at those cases, you know, differently and explore why it is that these kids even get killed either by civilians or by police officers because of the presumption that they are dangerous and criminal. And so I really collected those stories and began to do the research that would help explain that, right? So the book has research on the traumatic effects of policing and over-policing of Black and Brown children. There's research on the history of police in schools and how the evolution of police in schools has a racialized history. There's also, you know, data, but all of the research and the data is told in a very plain language way. So this book is very much meant to be a book for a mass audience, for everyone to read. My hope for this book is that every reader will pick it up and see themselves somewhere in this book and say, ah, I did that when I was a child, or I see my kids doing that. And we would never prosecute them, arrest them for those kinds of behaviors. And so that for me was the main process. What are the stories that need to be told to change hearts and to change minds? And what is the research that support it so that folks don't walk away from this book thinking, oh, that's just a collection of anecdotes.
Right, of course. You know, I think it's notable that one of the things you opened with was saying you only represented me four white children in your experience as a public defender. And then, yeah, the question probably as a researcher or someone who would be putting forward findings or data, or as someone who's trying to evaluate the information being presented to them. Yeah, the question is, is that truly a reflection of the criminal activity, the population, or is that a reflection of weakness in the system and in our society? And so I think that, you know, from what we've been saying, you've been laying out the case very well, that we're looking at disparate treatment here and bias in the system. So of course, our goal today is to provide an introduction to your book and not necessarily have you walk us through each finding, data point, and conclusion put forward, because we're hoping that our listeners are, of course, going to read the book and get the full context and substance of the book and the benefit of that. But for those listeners out there that might not get around to reading this book, again, a hypothetical, we're not encouraging, but let's say someone doesn't get to your book, but is listening now, and you have a chance to share with them and leave them with some thoughts. What would you want them to know about the criminalization of Black youth in America?
Well, I think there are probably three things. One is that we have to remember that Black children are children too. And I think we in America often forget that. We have become so extraordinarily afraid of Black children based on the narratives that have been passed, you know, from generation to generation, from the media attention to, you know, isolated examples of high profile crime, you know, committed by Black children, but which is interesting because, you know, there have been high profile crimes committed by white kids as well. And we aren't quite as afraid of white children, but we live with a fear of Black children. And especially when we go through times in our country where there is a temporary uptick in crime, we immediately gravitate to and assume that Black children are disproportionately responsible for that crime, when the data has never borne that out, right? It's just the crime that gets the most attention. That's one takeaway, is that we have to stop being afraid of Black children and learn to treat all children like children. The second takeaway for me is to understand, to have listeners and hopefully readers really understand that we are doing more harm than good with many of our contemporary policing responses. And research shows that there is a growing body of evidence that Black and Brown children experience significant trauma when they are living in heavily surveilled neighborhoods or the target of frequent stops and frisks by the police. The research shows that Black and Brown youth who live in these conditions report high rates of fear, anxiety, depression, hopelessness. They become hypervigilant, meaning that they always on guard and not trusting police officers, and that distrust of the police transfers over to other state actors like teachers and counselors, all of whom, you know, want to be allies for children. And so the traumatic effects actually increase crime instead of reducing crime. They increase stress that leads to increased crime. And so we have to be thoughtful about what are the most effective strategies for public safety. And that brings me to my third takeaway, which is that we really need to invest in a public health approach to public safety and to school safety, instead of our automatic default to traditional law enforcement responses, and that we can actually radically reduce the footprint of police officers in the lives of all children, and especially Black and Brown children who have been targeted. And we can do so by adopting this public health approach that is attentive to the relationships between children and adults, that is trauma informed, that is racially equitable, and that is restorative, that seeks to restore relationships after conflicts. And so what does that look like on the ground? So for example, in a school setting, we need more counselors to replace many officers in the school system. We need social emotional learning within the academic curriculum. We need positive behavior interventions and vocational opportunities for young people. We need restorative justice that I talked about earlier within the school system. And even in schools where there is some evidence of crime, we need credible messengers and violence interrupters who are uniquely trained and have experience in young people's context, in their neighborhoods and context and social, racial, and ethnic background to engage with young people to improve safety. So those would be my three main takeaways. But again, I hope everyone will either read or even get the audiobook and check it out.
Yes, of course. Thank you, Kristen. Well, and listeners, we've certainly discussed youth and the criminal justice system several times on our podcast. A couple of episodes that I would point you to if you are listening to this episode and are wanting to hear more. We had a school to prison pipeline episode, one where we talked about the intersection of the foster care system and juvenile justice, as well as collateral consequences, where we also discussed the impact of a youth having an interaction with the criminal justice system and how that can impact their life for quite a while, and how it can be completely life-changing, life-altering. So I'd point you toward those and encourage you to listen to those as well, as in addition to, of course, reading or listening to Rage of Innocence, How America Criminalizes Black Youth. Once again, listeners, this was Kristen Henning, the Bloom Professor of Law and Director of the Juvenile Justice Clinic and Initiative at Georgetown Law, and a current member of the CJS Juvenile Justice Standards Task Force, which is responsible for putting forward standards that the intent is to serve as a guide for the nation in standards for the juvenile justice system. So that work will be coming forward in the future. So things to look forward to. So thank you again, Kristen, for joining us today. We appreciate your time and your insights and for highlighting this important topic for us.
Thank you so much, Emily, for having me again.
Yeah. Thank you again. And thank you to our listeners for joining us on this episode of the Just Pod.